este castigo mejor.
Good morning, and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation, by the way. On our last episode of Jonesy, we celebrated Halloween by pretty much ignoring it altogether. Today's episode might be a little more appropriate, not only for Halloween, but for the following day, as observed in Mexico, Día de los Muertos, or Day of the Dead, and the dead are the focus of today's show. Oops, wrong dead. Our guest is Sean Levy, author of the new book of poems, A Year in the Life of Death, from Portland's University of Hell Press. Inspired by an obituary for Adele Mailer in the New York Times, Sean decided to write 100 poems based on obits published in the Times from November 2015 through January 2017, and it happened to be a banner year for deaths. Some famous, like David Bowie, Prince, Muhammad Ali, Carrie Fisher and her mom Debbie Reynolds, Merle Haggard, Zsa Zsa Gabor, Leonard Cohen and Nancy Reagan, to name just a few, and some not so famous but well worth knowing. Sean's the author of 11 books, including Rat Pack Confidential, Paul Newman A Life, King of Comedy, The Life and Art of Jerry Lewis, and The Castle on Sunset. He served as film critic of The Oregonian from 1997 to 2012 and KGW-TV from 2009 to 2016. A former senior editor of American Film and former associate editor at Box Office, Sean's work has appeared in the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, the San Francisco Chronicle, The Guardian, Interview, Movie Line, and Sight and Sound, among others. A Year in the Life of Death is Sean's first book of poems, in the words of another wonderful Portland author, Lydia Yuknovich. Sean Levy has written Into the Mouth of Death with a mission: to reclaim joy, ecstasy, passion, the matter of art. This book is a wailing song, with side eye when and where you need it. These poems are a resuscitation of art and heart. Please join us for our conversation with Sean Levy, which is already in progress. Sean, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Ken.
Well, first, Sean, I have to say how much I enjoyed reading A Year in the Life of Death. It's a very entertaining book, especially in light of the subject matter, the dearly and the not so dearly departed. And it's a unique one. In the introduction, you mentioned you drew inspiration from an essay by Mo Davio that she read at Portland's Crush Bar. That was back in November 2015, around Thanksgiving. The subject was Adele Mailer, Norman Mailer's second wife and an artist, of course, in her own right, who had died just a few days before. How did that help birth the book, that kind of synchronicity between Mo and what you had been thinking of?
Well, I got to talking with Mo about Adele Mailer. Mo had worked at the Harry Ransom Archives at University of Texas, which houses Mailer's papers. And she knew Mailer's history with women. Adele is the wife he stabbed.
He stabbed,
famously.
Yes.
And I was also, I've been a lifelong clipper of obituaries. You know, I was a newspaper man for a couple of decades. I've written many biographies. So there's something about the obituary form that satisfies both sides of my brain, the sprint and the marathon. And I had clipped that obituary. And I had always been fascinated by the story of Adele Mailer as well. And as Mo and I got talking, I had recently started writing poetry again, sort of regularly. And I was trying to develop a practice that was different from the practice of writing nonfiction books, which is how I make my living. And in conversation, I just had this epiphany that I could use the New York Times obit pages every day and look for a prompt that, you know, it seemed to me that there was something every day I was interested in. Of course, I was exaggerating and I was dead wrong because it's a lot harder than that. But I began that practice at the end, you know, at the end of November 2015, and I decided I would do it for a year. And then that snowballed. The year 2016 turned out to be this epical year of famous deaths, The New York Times actually ran a story at the beginning of 2017 saying, no, it wasn't your imagination. More famous people died last year than most years, and they had some metrics to prove it. And as a result, I wound up, you know, one day I would wake up and there would be nothing in the paper, you know, a Bolivian general and a ballerina, nothing interesting to ignite the poem in me. And other days it would be David Bowie, Prince, John Glenn, Nancy Reagan, you know, in 2 weeks, Muhammad Ali, Gordie Howe, and Arnold Palmer. It was crazy. And there were people I knew, a couple of people who I had personal connections, like, you know, handshake acquaintance with. So it started as a whim, and then it became a crusade and a real project.
You kind of hit the obit lottery by picking that year.
It was crazy. Yeah. It was, you know, University of Hell Press has published this book in tandem with a book about 2020. And a friend of mine said, you know, these really were the two worst years I can remember. So, you know, good on you guys for, you know, of course, we didn't do this deliberately. It just happened that way.
I know, kind of the Trump era book ended there, yeah. 2016 to 2020. Now, there were all these obituaries, of course, to choose from. It was a record year, as you mentioned. How did you decide to narrow it down to 100 poems? 365 plus was just a bit too much?
Yeah, you know, there were, as I say, there were days when I would look at the obits and there would be nothing. Like, I would try and write, you know, based on something happening in a picture in one of the obits. And I was really sort of forcing myself through the exercise. And there were days when I just simply didn't get the paper. I was away. I would come back from traveling and sort of, you know, the papers would, I wouldn't have received the paper that those mornings. So I would look back and see what did I miss online, but I couldn't necessarily account for that. And it was just a lot, you know, to write 365. So somewhere in my head, the poet J.V. Cunningham has a book, his collected poems includes a century of epigrams. It's 100 epigrams. And he's using century in the old Roman sense of 100 of something. Yes. A centurion is one of 100 soldiers in his unit.
The Roman numeral C.
Yeah. And I thought, oh, I'll write a century of poems and it'll be called a century of death. But that was confusing because it was about a year. And I wound up writing about 160 and editing them with Eve Connell at University of Hell Press and with input from Shannon Brazil, my partner, and a couple of readers who I asked to look at the very earliest manuscript, including Mo Davio, some Portland authors, Mark Savage, Stephen Allred. So it was a question of like finding the 100 best and then also reckoning with the fact that I had of the first selection of 100, perhaps 85 were old white men. And the Times actually in 2017, and this project started in 2015, but I finished the work in 2020. In 2017, the Times published a section called Overlooked, explaining that, you know, we missed out on a lot of people because of our focus on a certain kind of achievement and a certain kind of achiever. And our obituary pages over the years have skewed extremely white, extremely male. And they ran obituaries of people they had not run in their time, including Sylvia Plath, Diane Arbus, Ida B. Wells. And then they did another Overlooked about a year later for people of color, including Scott Joplin. So it was shocking that the Times, you know, had missed these people, and commendable. There was a wonderful phrase that's quoted in my introduction that the obituaries are not a window on the world. They are a rear view mirror. They reflect what society was like 30 or 40 years ago when the people who are now dead made their, you know, important impact.
And that was white men at
yeah,
the time.
As it happened. Mm-hmm. So given that, I went back and I tossed about 15 poems from the original 100 and either beefed up or went back. I saved the paper, the obituary pages from every day. So I had them to go back and say, who here deserves to be in this company? And was able to, you know, make the poems, I feel, a little more representative of life as we experience it.
Now, you mentioned that you make your living from nonfiction books, and you've written 11 on famous film figures, Paul Newman, Jerry Lewis, the Rat Pack, the Chateau Marmont and its history. But while prepping for the interview, I was surprised to learn of your love for poetry as both a reader and a practitioner, which you mentioned. And you hold, which I didn't know, an MFA in poetry from UC Irvine, a very prestigious school for creative writing. Michael Chabon went there. Whitney Otto, a Portland-based writer, now received their MFA degrees there. But your professional life took a different turn. You didn't go into poetry.
Whitney and Michael were classmates of mine.
Oh, I didn't know that.
They were in school together. In the fiction workshop.
In fiction, yes.
And I was in the poetry workshop, and a couple of the poets who I was with went on to, you know, do careers in poetry, which is to say they taught somewhere.
They taught poetry, yes.
Paul Marion in Lowell, Mass. Juan Delgado in San Bernardino, California. They've published multiple books, and they still write poetry all the time. The difference was when we were in grad school, I became a dad.
That will do it.
And I needed to earn a living, and I was still writing poetry, although the MFA program, as I experienced it, my slender author's ego at the time didn't cotton to it, because I had a different concept of poetry than a lot of my classmates, and my stuff would get sort of buffeted around. You said the book is entertaining. And my favorite poets are Frank O'Hara, Walt Whitman, John Berryman. They are entertaining
yes.
to read, and they are talking about, their heart and their grief and their vulnerability, but they also have the power to please. And to me, that seemed important. And I would get a lot of pushback that kind of soured me on poetry, and I needed to make a living.
They didn't think you were literary enough in your poems or
sincere, I think is, they recognized the craft and, the language, but they were like, this is, immature.
Wow.
And no doubt it was. No doubt it was. I was like 23 years old.
So but that's why you're in a writing program, right?
Yeah. But it, as I say, it had a lot to do with how I received it and my ego being so thin about like, wait, you don't love everything I do? And So the combination of being slightly soured on poetry and needing to make a living, I answered a want ad in the LA Times for an editor at a film magazine, and I got the job. That was 1988. And I did that professionally until 2016.
Did you write any poems during that time?
There was one brief period. I was on walkabout in 2010 in South America for a couple of months. And I had an experience that reminded me of the years when I lived overseas in between college and graduate school. And I would, sort of buy the International Herald Tribune and nurse it all day in a cafe and write poems in a notebook. And I was in Buenos Aires, in Jorge Luis Borges' favorite cafe. And I started to write poems. And weirdly enough, one of those actually got published. Maybe the only poem I published in 35 years. And it was a poem about Lionel Messi, the great Argentine soccer player.
Yeah, he's still around.
He's still around. I happened to be in Buenos Aires during World Cup 2010.
Wow.
So Messi was everywhere. And I wrote about him, and I wrote also about Cristiano Ronaldo. And those two poems, if I were to go on and do a book of collected poems, I think they would make it. But then I shut down again. I came back to the States and started working on books, and I was still at the newspaper. And it wasn't until 2015 when I started to, I had been spending more time in the Portland literary community, the communities around corporeal writing and dangerous writing, a lot of the reading series, the regular reading series that happened around in the before times. Then I started writing poetry, and then I hit on this idea.
Was that a difficult transition, going from the prose of your nonfiction books to poetry, getting the form and the language correct?
So much of the prose, I like to contend that there was always poetry going on in my reviews in the Oregonian and in the pages of my books. I would have quoted, Hart Crane and William Carlos Williams and Emily Dickinson regularly in the pages of the Oregonian in reviewing movies. I wouldn't say, as Hart Crane said, I would steal the phrase. And I'd like to think that there were six people on Earth who happened to read a review of an Adam Sandler movie or a Bruce Willis movie who would see that phrase and say, oh, my God, this guy is quoting such and such. So it was always there. And I always felt like my passion for language, the rhythm of language, vocabulary, syntax was evidence of my poetry background. So that was always in there. And there's such a different impulse between being told, okay, by Wednesday at noon, I need five reviews plus all the other apparatus that goes into a paper. Or by July 1st, 2 years from now, I need to have 150,000 word biography of Robert De Niro. That writing prompt is very different from, oh, I like that phrase. I wonder if I can do something with that phrase. Let me write that phrase down. Do I want to sit here and write it, or I want to go to a cafe? I mean, it's just a different experience. And I'm sure there are poets, you know, who write every day in the way that I write prose, that they sit in the same chair at a desk. But I had to find my way back into a practice. And this project gave me the prompt, but I also had to find, how am I doing this? Am I doing it by hand? Am I writing on a computer? Am I doing it in notebooks? Where am I doing it?
I noticed in the book, Sean, that you use the second person. You're addressing the recently deceased, the subject of the obituary, with a you. And it's a long tradition in poetry. I looked up from my school years, Andrew Marvel's To His Coy Mistress,
sure.
Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone, you know, centuries later. What were your reasons for that direct address, the you?
At a certain point in writing, I realized that the most fluent voice that I could summon was in, it was kind of an ode and it was kind of an elegy. And it also had the intimacy of me talking to this person. And sometimes this person was, you know, a titanic figure, Muhammad Ali, David Bowie. And sometimes it was someone I knew, Catherine Dunn. A poem that didn't make the cut was for Lawrence Van Gelder, who was my editor at the New York Times, the two times I wrote book reviews for the Times. And it just felt like that was where the fertile soil was. It was in that voice. I really feel like if I wanted to in 2022 or 2024, I could pick up the project again because I found the way to do it. Just, you know, sort of like Berryman's Dream Songs or a sonnet sequence. You know, you hit on the form, you hit on the voice, and they're not all going to be bangers, but you know, you have the medium and you know how to do it. And the second person just, of the many poems that I started with and the many gambits I tried, that was the one that was most fertile.
Oh, yeah, certainly gives it an immediacy. I want to give our listeners like a sample, maybe start with one of the odes. And one I really appreciated was almost a saintly tribute based in the obit for the poet, the singer-songwriter, and part-time monk, Leonard Cohen, who died in November 2016 at the age of 82.
God bless. We should point out that they all have, there's another trick of the form. They all the poems are untitled and end with the headline from the print edition of the New York Times.
I know, which, I should have given a spoiler alert there.
It's okay, it's okay. It creates this unboxing effect because there's certain traditions in the New York Times of mentioning the age and the notability of the person and their name in the headline. So the headline kind of, if you don't even read the obituary, you say, oh, a famous mathematician died at 94. You know this just from the headline. and I decided that was like a nice way to sort of put a twist in each poem very early in the process. I see you on your knees before a teacher, lover, tape recorder, desk, an emblem of serene humility, a thought you'd no doubt deem a vanity. I saw you once for real in my hometown, in Twain, in fact, not only in the flesh, but on a giant screen. Indeed, in threes, your shadow huge on cobalt scrims behind you. And I've spied you in places you never were, the temples of Black Rock City, the light on waterfalls and mists, the eyes of a certain woman, some words drilled into my arm in ink. It's a measure of your weight for me that the more I think about you, the more I think about you. And I esteem you as a holy man, as often as a poet, imp, roué, sensei, comedian, wandering Jew, all of which you were, and which names you'd no doubt lay claim to sooner than you would the hero's crown I hold above your head, which makes me love you all the more.
I loved it because I felt the same way about Leonard Cohen.
Things were so screwed up in 2016 that we learned about his death on Thursday of the week of the election. And then we learned that he had died on Monday. And more than one person said, thank God Leonard Cohen didn't live to see this.
Oh my, I've been thinking a lot about people who died before that era.
Yeah.
You know, and the COVID era. And now maybe another famous death, but on the opposite end of the spectrum, so they're not all saintly. Something you don't see in most every obituary, which tries to focus on the positives in a person's life, or at the very least attempts to stay neutral, just reporting the facts. But in your book, in the poems, you could loosen up a bit and write how you really feel. And there was a poem about Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia, who was lionized, I guess, by the Republicans and Trump during that election, 2016, but not by the rest of us. He died on Valentine's Day in 2016 at the age of 79. And this is a very clever format.
Yeah, this was one of the ones that just rolled out. Like the day of the death, I knew exactly what I was going to write. Quote, of the dead, nothing but good is to be said. Chelon of Sparta, philosopher, 600 BC. Quote, I'll be glad when you're dead, you rascal, you. Sam Feard, songwriter, 1929. Quote, I have never killed anyone, but I have read some obituary notices with great satisfaction. Clarence Darrow, lawyer, 1932. Quote, his own worst enemy? Not while I'm alive, he's not. Walter George, congressman, 1938. Quote, if you can't say something nice about someone, then don't say anything at all. Everyone's mom, ever. Justice Antonin Scalia is dead at 79.
You know, may he rest in peace and stay there.
Yeah, I tried to focus on generosity. You know, even the people who were sort of problematic in their deeds or in my recollection of them. You know, my father was a Brooklyn Dodgers fan.
Oh, yeah, you have a Ralph Branca poem.
Yeah, his heart was broken by Ralph Branca, who gave up one of the most famous home runs and the most bitter rivalry, sports rivalry of its era. And my father, you could get a rise out of him by just, you know, walking past him while he was watching Mannix reruns and say, Ralph Branca. And I tried to wrestle with that. You know, I have nothing against Ralph Branca, but I was bored to think of his name as practically like a profane expression. So, you know, there are murderers in this book. There are people who, you know, who in life I did not care for. And there's someone in this book who didn't care for me. Frank Sinatra Jr. resented things I wrote about his father in my book Rat Pack Confidential. And when we were both solicited to contribute to another Rat Pack book, a very large art book that retailed for $800, Frank Sinatra decided to devote his foreword to tearing me down. And the publisher said, I'm sorry, we're not going to do that. You know, forget it. We're not going to use your piece. But, you know, the publisher said he stamped his Uggs on this tile floor in his house. And, you know, I wrote a poem about Frank Sinatra that dealt with that. And I was like, no, you know, that's not the story of his life. That's to do with me. And I wrote a different poem about Frank Sinatra Jr. and how hard it must have been to walk around the world named Frank Sinatra Jr.
You know, I read that poem, and as you mentioned, you don't really give the headline in the obit until the end. And I was thinking, if it was taken a little bit metaphorically, it could be Donald Trump Jr.
Yeah.
any junior, any son of a notoriously famous father who was following in those footsteps, but didn't do the best job of doing that.
And has that name. I mean, you know what? And Frank Sinatra Jr. wasn't even a junior. The father was Francis Albert. The son was Franklin Emmanuel. But such was the father's shadow that he became Frankie Jr.
Now, we mentioned the Ralph Branca. I should, to kind of recuperate his reputation, it turned out that the Giants were actually cheating. They did sign stealing, and Bobby Thompson knew a fastball was coming and hit it over the left field wall. So
yeah,
and it wasn't Ralph Branca's fault.
He also wore number 13.
Well, that could do it.
Kind of asking for it.
But you had with the humor, which we saw in the Scalia obit poem, you have an athlete that a lot of people don't know, but he was a pioneer NBA star and big man, even though he was only 6'8", but that was big at the time. Dolph Schayes, he died in December 2015 at the age of 87. And unlike Schayes, this poem is a short one.
Yeah. And, you know, his son, Danny, played in the NBA.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. Danny Schayes played for the Denver Nuggets. He was also a center.
Oh, okay. Yes. I know the name. I just didn't make the connection.
Anyway, there are jokes in this book because it's a book about death. And if you're not telling jokes about death, you're really not getting the point.
Right.
Anyhow, in retrospect, it's hard to say which is more amazing. That there was a time when Jews dominated the basketball court, or that there was a time when Jews named their children Adolf. And yet, there you were, both.
Just perfect. Right to the point and very, very funny. Now, you mentioned Catherine Dunn, and you have a section at the end of the book called The Personals. And you mentioned a few other obits that you have personal connections with. It's called Personals in Keeping with the Newspaper Theme. And it gives you a chance to explore your own connections to the people who died. You've said that some of these poems are, I quote, easily the most personal thing I've ever written. Yeah. One of the subjects, and you already mentioned her name, Catherine Dunn, is near and dear to those of us at KABU. She actually did a show here, A Gremlin Time. She was Red Ryder, and she read stories to listeners. And of course, Catherine was a big part of the Portland literary community, both as a novelist and as a boxing writer. And you knew her personally. She was a good friend and very supportive of you. She died in May 2016 at the age of 70. And this is the penultimate poem in the book.
The last time I saw you outside movie madness on a spring afternoon in the company of your husband, a college beau with whom you'd reconnected, you were, as I'll always remember you, smiling, laughing, sweet, asking what I'd seen, what I was writing. I was always running into you like that, Trader Joe's, coffee time, the occasional screening or party, and you couldn't have been more dear or, for want of a female equivalent, avuncular. Huh. Aunt Catherine, who adopted me the moment I rolled into Oregon and was kind to me and my work in ways I've never fully been myself. That fond aura you bore into the world was hard to reconcile with your art, so full of blood and hurt and gross, a shadowland of dark and weird. A mystery that the words that conjured all of that came from a soul so homey, so down to earth. But of course, your empathy for one was empathy for all. And the way you spoke of freaks and villains and, when I best knew you, boxers, even Iron Mike Tyson, who you swore was absolutely right to chomp an ear and defend himself, was another aspect of your native need to check up on the world. That was your heart in action, vision beneath the obvious, finding the human core, making us know its taste. And so, weeks after that last encounter, when the shock of your passing rippled the community you made, I recognized with shame that I didn't ask enough after you, that something in me left me dumb and blind, that I didn't see beneath your skin, where, despite the sun and grins and niceties, something lurked that would take you soon and fast. And so this adieu, which is also a thanks, is as well an I'm sorry for being trapped inside myself, for not asking questions, for not seeing the you in you, for having been unable to connect as I now wish I had with a heart so rare and dear and true.
That's a beautiful tribute.
Thank you. That was a shocking day. We ran into her. I introduced her to my partner, Shannon, and it was all smiles and laughter. And it was April, and she died in May. And the day we met her, she did not know she was ill.
Oh, she didn't know. She died of cancer, by the way.
She died of cancer, and it was diagnosed, and she was gone, which is how my mom went as well. And it was just shocking. And I'll never forget that my partner was upset with me because she said, why didn't you ask her more questions about yourself? You know, this was right after we met. But that was an ordinary upset. Something else. If there was an empath in this world, it is my partner.
Shannon Brazil.
And she just felt something very strange about that encounter. And when we heard this shocking news 4 or 5 weeks later, Shannon was like, I don't want to claim credit for knowing this, but there was something between us on that day. And, you know, I think Catherine would sign off on that, you know, that such forms of intuition are part of the world.
Oh, definitely. Well, Sean, one final question, and maybe the most final of all, as your experience in writing this book and taking that deep dive into so many obituaries, you know, that record year for deaths, 2016, caused you to reconsider your own views on death and the impermanence of not just these lives, but all our lives?
Yeah, you know, simultaneously, you know, I got the idea 6 years ago and I had just celebrated my 60th birthday. So you'd have to be daffy not to think, okay, well, one of the ways I used to use the obituaries, I still do this. I look at the Times obituaries, say there are three obituaries, 78, 94, and 83. I add them up, divide by three, I get a number. And it's like doing the I Ching. Some days the number is very high and I think I'm going to eat dessert and skip the gym. And some days the number is younger than me and I'm like, Jiminy Cricket, time for an extended workout. You know, I'm eating kale for dinner. And it's just this memento mori that the obituaries give us whole lives. The lives are over. In many cases, there are obscure people in this book. You know, we've shared, you know, poems about notable people, but, you know, I encountered people I'd never heard of. The fellow who chose the at symbol for email,
right.
A guy who took weather reports on the eastern end of Long Island three times a day for 85 years without fail, you know, and people like this whose lives you wouldn't know other than the fact that someone at the New York Times made the decision to publish the obituary. And you know, I still read the obituaries every day. I look for cause of death, who confirmed it, who the survivors are. I like to see where they were born, what their parents did, which is often included. And that knowledge does live with me, that, you know, particularly as I get older, that there are choices I make every day that could wind up in that obituary.
Right. That sense of our own mortality.
Yeah, and the mortality, the inscription of it literally in this case in pen and paper or you know in pixels on a screen, in the form of an obituary, is a very real thing. There's a couple of people in this book who were interviewed by the New York Times in advance of their death to get the obituary rounded out.
Kind of in anticipation.
You know, I mean, you're not going to get away, so you might as well contribute, you know. You can literally have the last word if you're cooperative.
Now, before we go, I'd like to give a big thanks to your editor and publisher. You mentioned Eve Connell, also Greg Gerding of Portland's University of Hell Press, and to our good radio friend, Gigi Little, who's been on KBOO on my shows in the past. She did her typically amazing job on the book's cover and interior design. And Sean, a big thank you to you, of course, for sharing your poetry with us today and the time during release week and the launch.
Oh, I really appreciate it. It's being part of the Portland literary community in the oblique way I have been as a journalist and sort of nonfiction writer has been one experience. The experience of writing poetry and having this community, yourself included, embrace this very quixotic project has been one of the great experiences of my professional life. It's an honor to be among y'all.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would just like to hear it all again, you can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, Sean Levy, author of the new book of poems, A Year in the Life of Death, from Portland's University of Hell Press. You can find out more about Sean, the new book, and all his work on his website, Sean, S-H-A-W-N, Levy.com. Sean will be launching the new book this evening, along with another new University of Hell Press title, 2020, The Year of the Asterisk, at Mother Foucault's bookstore in Southeast Portland. The event starts at 6:30 p.m. Sean will also be appearing at the Portland Book Festival this Saturday, November 13th. He'll be spending most of the day at the University of Hell table in the festival's exhibit hall and invites you all to drop by, say hello, and get your book signed if you're so inclined. KBOO, by the way, is your community radio station, and we get over 80% of our funding from our members. To support the station and programming like this, there's no better time to become a member yourself or renew your membership. Just go to kboo.fm and click on the big donate button. All of us here at the station, even Jonesy himself, thank you for that. Just a note that Jonesy comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 11 to 11:30 a.m. Our next show, Thanksgiving Day, November 25th, will be preempted for KBOO's special holiday programming. But you can catch us again next month on Thursday, December 9th at 11 a.m. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying, hope to see you all again then, you rascal you.